Welcome to The Political Scene from The New Yorker, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Susan Glasser, and I'm joined by my colleagues Evan Osnos and Jane Mayer. Hello, Evan.
Hey there, Susan.
Hey, Jane.
Hi.
Sometimes one event can focus attention on a crisis in a way that facts and figures alone simply can't. This week, we saw one such tragic event, really. On Monday in Gaza, 7 aid workers were killed in a series of Israeli airstrikes. The victims were Australian, British, Palestinian, Polish, a dual citizen of Canada and the United States. They were all part of the World Central Kitchen, a nonprofit founded by celebrity chef Jose Andres that has played a critical role in feeding Gazans during the war. Their deaths, just a few out of so very many, have become a focal point for outrage over Israel's handling of the war in Gaza. And even more than that, I think here in Washington, they have resounded particularly loudly, not only because World Central Kitchen is based here in Washington, D.C., but in a way because it's a small number of deaths that symbolizes not only the larger awful whole, but I think the policy and political bind in which the Biden administration has found himself. President Biden, in a statement, said he was outraged and heartbroken by the deaths. He followed that up with a very, very tough call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which Biden did something he has resisted doing for a long time, which is conditioning future American aid on new steps to be taken by Israel to protect civilians more than they have been and to provide for additional humanitarian aid. Just hours later, you did see the beginnings of some response by Israel, taking steps to open a key crossing, for example, from Israel into Gaza that has been closed for months. But is it enough? What does it really mean? And 6 months in, more broadly, is this the moment that we might finally be seeing a shift in the Biden administration's handling of the war between Israel and Hamas? Today, we'll try to talk about those questions and dig into why the Biden administration has been so stuck when it comes to navigating this particular crisis. And we'll phone an expert to help us unpack whether the laws of war have actually been violated in this conflict. Evan, you and all of us on the pod, you know, we know Jose Andres. You've reported about him. You've spent a lot of time with him. Why do you think this kind of, you know, it's obviously just one tragedy at a time when there's an enormous scale of suffering, but it's resonated here. Tell us what's happened with the attack and why you think it matters.
Well, I think just in terms of the particulars, this attack happened on Monday night in Gaza. There were 7 members of World Central Kitchen's team that had been unloading food that had arrived in this kind of this makeshift jetty that they'd set up. And they were heading south, and the first car in their convoy was hit, and the survivors got out of that car. This way, they were hit with a drone-fired missile. They got out and moved into a second car. That car was hit. They moved into a third car, and that car was hit. The IDF, the Israel Defense Force, came forward and said this was a mistake. They called it a case of misidentification. They then went further and detailed what happened. The crux of it, according to their preliminary investigation, is that a drone operator mistook somebody carrying a bag for somebody carrying a gun, and perhaps even more importantly, that the officers on the ground did not adequately review the details of what this convoy was doing and where it was going and why it was there. The big question, and this is part of the reason why World Central Kitchen came out and said, we're not satisfied with that, is we want an independent investigation, and they want to talk about systemic change, meaning not just were these errors of low-level officers, but what does this say about the governance system around civilian life and around the provision of aid in Gaza? And I think that's the big next question people will be looking at.
And of course, here in Washington, Jane, I think it just it part of it was also timing, right? You know, you have this brewing debate about, you know, the war and what Biden's policy of support for Israel, is it sustainable? Obviously, politically, he's taking a hit. What's your view about why this one of all the tragedies has particularly struck? Was it just the timing? Was it something specific to, you know, targeting these people who are, you know, coming into a dangerous war zone and actually trying to provide aid when governments seem to have failed?
I mean, I think it's all of the above, but I think that one of the things that's most important is, and I think you've pointed this out, is that in Washington, José Andrés is not just a distant figure. He is both a celebrity and a neighbor. People know him and admire him. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that worldwide, you know, in the fog of war, it's kind of hard to say who's right, who's wrong, what really happened. But I think when you have somebody like José Andrés and his World Central Kitchen, he's just completely, we all know, on the side of the angels. He is a good guy. So when somebody like that, trying to do this humanitarian mission, gets in the crosshairs of our allies, and these casualties were so tragic, I think everybody stands back and says, this is an outrage. And we all feel it on some level. And we'll talk later with our expert on humanitarian war. But part of the reason also is the delivery of food. Food is very required under international law. Starvation is not a tactic that is allowed under international law. So this particular mission, I think, violated sort of everybody's moral standards.
Susan, I think, you know, the other thing, there have been about 200 aid workers that have been killed before this incident. And so part of the reason why this took on this larger power was that it seemed symbolic of these kinds of larger systemic questions. But I'm curious what you make of the resonance, the reverberations, why you think this became as big as it did.
Yeah, well, look, there's no question that it comes at a moment here in Washington when many Democrats have been pressuring Biden publicly and privately, but increasingly publicly, including senators on Capitol Hill who have long, long records of supporting Israel, but they have been pressuring Biden, you know, to really kind of turn the screws more on Netanyahu and the Israeli government, that this has really been an unacceptable way in which the war is being prosecuted almost too directly on the backs of civilians, not only the high civilian toll, but as Jane mentioned, we've had in recent weeks reports suggesting that basically more than half of the population of Gaza is at food insecure already and at actual risk of a man-made famine in Gaza if more dramatic steps are not taken. You saw that a few weeks ago. The Biden administration came out and said, well, we'll do things that I thought were extraordinary at the time, right, Evan? You know, was this idea, well, we're going to have airdrops of humanitarian aid. We're going to build this pier off of Gaza to deliver by the sea humanitarian aid. Why is that the U.S. military has to go around its own military ally, Israel, to provide more assistance to the people of Gaza? So already, I think it was unsustainable in this piece of it. Really struck a chord for that reason.
I think, you know, something else that may be worth saying, at least I see criticism to some extent out there, that it took casualties who were non-Palestinian to really grab the attention, finally, of America and particularly the Biden administration. And I mean, I don't know if that's fair, but it did tip the balance to have a celebrity American involved in this tragedy.
Yeah, Evan, I did notice that in Biden's statement, he called José Andrés pointedly my friend. Mm. And, you know, a lot of politics, especially international diplomacy, is often personal, in particular with Biden, who's a believer in long-term yeah. relationships. That seemed to have conditioned his initial decision to offer Netanyahu support, despite the kind of fraught relations. How personal is it for Biden? And, you know, what does that mean in terms of that? Imagine that phone call. I've been imagining that phone call. Do you think the president, is he yelling at Bibi? Is he just, you know, laying it on the line, like, this is it, buddy, and you better listen?
Well, I think, I mean, politics is also not just personal. It's also about stories. And in some ways, part of the reason why this tragedy has had this larger resonance is because it is a story that in some ways makes sense to Joe Biden. Look, somebody in Israel pointed out to me, I was talking to a journalist a couple days ago who said, Joe Biden talked to two people that day. He talked to the president of China and he talked to the chef Jose Andres. In that way, kind of how large this looms in Biden's sort of windscreen at that moment. And the fact is, you know, the story of why Biden has been slow to move on Israel is personal as well. It goes to the very roots of how he sees himself as a political person, which is to say it goes all the way back to his first visit to Israel in 1973.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Golda Meir. Right?
Exactly.
How many times have we heard that story?
Well, and as you know, Susan, because you're a biographer, you cannot write about politics without understanding the fusion between story, between life, between what made James Baker or Donald Trump and what made Joe Biden. That story of Israel to him, the idea of Israel, is a very powerful element. I think there is another thing, which is also that on some level, he's been trying to do the old playbook for him, which is to work this behind the scenes with another politician. One of his theories is never try to tell another politician what his local politics are. And I think the local politics here matter. In the last couple of days before this call, you saw that Bibi Netanyahu was under extraordinary pressure. A member of his war cabinet, Benny Gantz, came out, called for early elections in September. You also saw the largest demonstrations, including outside of Netanyahu's house, since the war began. So a lot of factors came together that, in a sense, make sense of the political story that Joe Biden then saw a moment here. And that call, I know sometimes this can sound like it's all, you know, swaddled in diplomatic language, but if you know what you're reading, it's significant. And you, of course, do, Susan. I mean, saying that U.S. policy will be contingent on actions in the next few hours and days, that's a different place than where we were a few days ago.
That's right. And Jane, you know, just to the point about playbook, you know, and domestic politics, talking about Netanyahu's politics, Biden also has politics. We'll talk about it a little bit more later in our show. But in a way, you got to wonder if Biden's playbook is the old playbook and if he's finally, you know, if this call is the beginning of recognizing that the politics of Israel have changed here at home. What do you think?
I think absolutely. I mean, and you can see it changing on the Hill. Even some of the senators that are considered his closest allies on the Hill, Chris Coons, for instance, have begun to really push back against Biden and say we need to make the aid conditional or set down some limits here for what Israel's doing.
You know, Jane, I'm glad you brought up Senator Coons, who is one of Biden's closest allies and partners from Delaware. To me, that was a classic Washington moment where you had Coons on television on CNN.
I think we're at the point where President Biden has said, and I have said, and others have said, if Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister, were to order the IDF into Rafah at scale, they were to drop 1,000-pound bombs and send in a battalion to go after Hamas and make no provision for civilians or for humanitarian aid, that I would vote to condition aid to Israel. I've never said that before. I've never been here before.
And, you know, I turned to my husband, White House correspondent. I said, okay,
what it means
is that later today, this is exactly where the administration is going to head. Because that's how it works, right? You're going to get out there and give cover to your guy, and it means the wind has shifted. Is it subtle or not? But to me, I also took note of that.
They had already shifted.
But can I just say, I just don't think, though, that we should suggest that Biden was leading the way and the senators were all following. Because, in fact, he was lagging behind some of the leaders among the Democrats in the Senate, you know, whether it was Bernie Sanders, it was Peter Welch, it was Murphy from Connecticut. These guys were out there ahead of him, and he was feeling some heat from the party.
And Sanders especially is important here, because Sanders, after all, is a friend of Israel. He's also somebody who has been very explicit about his concerns, his criticisms. And I think Joe Biden needs Bernie Sanders for a lot politically. And actually, something that people don't know that much about, they have he talks to him a lot.
Speaking of pressure that Biden is under, there's a whole other arena that I think is increasingly important, and that is the arena of international pressure and international law. And when we come back, I'm really excited about this, but we're going to bring, an important expert on to talk to us about what international law actually has to say and not say, by the way, about the war between Israel and Hamas.
Thank you. I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, Philippe.
Hi.
Can you hear us?
Yep,
this is Susan Glasser from The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being with us.
In case our listeners don't know, Philippe Sands is a world-renowned expert on human rights law. He teaches law in unheard of places like Harvard and University College London. He's also a British barrister who represents clients before the International Court of Justice and all kinds of other international courts and tribunals. So we should point out
that not only does he represent clients before the International Court of Justice, but that one of those clients, not related to the war in Gaza, is the state of Palestine. And he has been acting as a counsel for the state of Palestine, advocating for its right to self-determination. Which is something we are interested to hear about, but I think it's important to make that disclosure in this conversation.
Totally.
Absolutely right. Thank you for doing that.
Well, Philippe, Jane had the great idea to, you know, have you help inform our conversation today. Maybe you can start out with this question of genocide. You do write about the actual origins of the word genocide, and the lawyer Raphael Lemkin, who created this concept in the midst of World War II, almost certainly never foreseeing, where and how it would travel in the world. We see that word thrown around so much right now. Tell us how you think about the use of this word in this current conflict.
Sure. So I think it's really important to understand that there are three legal concepts in play. You've got war crimes, which is when a war is underway, for example, targeting civilians. Secondly, you've got crimes against humanity, which is about the protection of individuals from widespread and systematic attack. And then thirdly, you've got this concept of genocide, which is about the protection of groups as opposed to individuals. And that was invented by Raphael Lemkin in 1944, he was committed really to protecting sort of global human diversity and wanted to protect groups and cultures and wanted international law rules to do that. It was a brand new idea invented out of the sky. He tried to get it into the Nuremberg trial. It never made its way into the judgment in 1946. And then he went to the first meeting of the United Nations in 1946 and got them to agree to draft a convention, a treaty. That was adopted in 1948, and that has been in force ever since. And that is why there is so much discussion. The concept of genocide in that convention means acts which are intended to destroy a group in whole or in part. And the difficulty with the word is that over the past 75 years, as cases have gone to international courts and tribunals, they've narrowed down the scope of the definition, essentially by setting a very high bar on proving intention. And the final point to make is that unlike genocide, for war crimes and crimes against humanity, there's no way to get to the International Court of Justice to make allegations that these crimes are being perpetrated. And so very often, horrible things happening are shoehorned into a definition of the word genocide, and that has meant that there's an increasing gap between sort of ordinary folks' understanding of what genocide is, namely doing horrible things to large numbers of people on a massive scale, on the one hand, and the legal definition, which is much narrower and much tighter.
So when you hear the word thrown around in the context of Gaza, as an expert on this, do you think it's appropriate or not appropriate?
So let me take you back a couple of years, not to the case of Gaza, but to another case that's going on, which is Russia and Ukraine. And you remember in March, April 2022, there were terrible attacks on a town called Bucha in Ukraine. And we had terrible images, large number of civilians being killed. And at that point, President Biden intervened and said, that looks to me like a genocide. And I was asked by the New York Times to write an op-ed. Is he right about that? And I said, well, he's right in the sense that the concept in public discourse means doing nasty things to large numbers of people unlawfully, but the legal definition is very different. And what happened at Butcher did not look to me like definition in the legal sense, because it was motivated, probably we don't know exactly what the facts were, not only by an intention to destroy people who happen to be Ukrainian, but to, if you like, whether it's act in self-defense or take combat operations and so on and so forth. And that brings you to the essential difficulty. The International Court of Justice ruled back in 2007 and 2015 in cases brought by Bosnia and Croatia against Serbia that to prove genocide in international law, you have to prove that the only intention is to destroy the group in whole or in part. I think that's a really rather absurd definition to take, because it means if you've got a double intention, namely respond to a terror attack, act in self-defense or whatever, as well as an intention to destroy a group in whole or in part, as a matter of law, that won't be genocide. And that's a simple or not so simple way of getting to the issue of Gaza. The difficulty the court will face in the case brought by South Africa against Israel is that the intentions of Israel, or Israel has said, it has a range of different intentions. They're not to destroy groups in whole or in part. They're to act in self-defense and so on and so forth. And that's the challenge for the court. Does it stick with its original sort of high bar definition, or does it regularize the definition? Interestingly, Ireland announced last week that it was going to intervene in that case precisely to persuade the court to revisit its definition of genocide in law and make it more consonant with what ordinary folk might consider to be genocidal acts.
Philippe, on that question of how this may play out in court, I wonder, you know, when you wear your hat as counsel for the state of Palestine, part of that is anticipating arguments of the other side. And I wonder how Israel does express its position here. How do you anticipate, knowing what you know, how do they talk about how they have thought about international law on these questions?
Just to be clear, I mean, there are two cases before the international court. One is the case brought by South Africa against Israel alleging genocide. I'm not involved in that case. The case that I'm involved in is a parallel case on the occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the illegality, as Palestine believes it to be, and most people believe it to be, of the settlements and the occupation. And that's the case that I'm involved in. But that said, when it comes to a lot of other issues, we know that Israel sets great store in claiming to be governed by international legal principles in its actions. And it is the case that it has many lawyers in its Ministry of Foreign Affairs and in its defense forces who are looking at issues of international law. But here, speaking completely personally, just looking at the images that we see and the sheer numbers of civilians who are said to have been killed or injured by the attacks, it's very hard to see how that can be said to be consistent with international legal principles. Right now in Britain, for example, it is said, but it's not yet been confirmed, that the Foreign Office lawyers have provided a legal opinion to the government expressing the view that what Israel is doing in Gaza is not consistent with international law, in particular international humanitarian law. It's a way of saying in shorthand they believe that war crimes are being committed.
I mean, Philippe, are the principles that you think are breaches here, or that could potentially be, is it has to do with proportionality, correct? In part,
I've always wondered
as a novice at this, so who defines what's proportional? You know,
well, I mean, coming back to these three categories: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Let's stick to war crimes, and that's where the issue of proportionality comes up. You have an obligation under international humanitarian law to distinguish between military targets and civilian targets. Obviously, in some instances, there's going to be a crossover between the two. And in that situation, your obligation is to not act disproportionately. In other words, you have to make sure that the terrible words collateral damage is very, very limited. And what we're apparently seeing in relation to Gaza plainly, in my view, and in the view of any, I think, reasonable observer, does not meet that standard. And therefore, it crosses the line into illegality precisely because it's disproportionate in affecting civilians.
So, Philippe, we got to let you go on with your day. This is, I think, very helpful for all of us. But there is, as Jane said, this kind of question of how do we sort through the scale of these particular atrocities or civilian deaths compared with so many other conflicts in the world? A lot of folks look at what happened in the war in Syria just next door to Israel and, don't see the same level of international outrage that was generated. You talked about British law, and that's very interesting if there's going to be a finding by the British Foreign Office that this is a violation. We have our own law here in the United States, the Leahy Law, which prohibits the United States from supporting any segments of a country's military that have been credibly accused for, quote, gross violation of human rights, unquote. But of course, we all know that the U.S. has at times supported many different regimes, including in Egypt, right next door to Israel. How do you deal with this problem yourself as a lawyer of, the differential standards that the world seems to apply in these conflicts?
I think it's a fascinating question. I mean, I deal with this in two ways. Firstly, I'd say, obviously, yes, the amount of attention that is given to certain conflicts as compared to others raises eyebrows. So first, there's a huge amount of attention given to Russia, Ukraine. Now there's a huge amount of attention given to Israel, Palestine. In the meantime, there are the most terrible atrocities taking place right now in Sudan that nobody is reporting about and which crosses the threshold way beyond what's happening, I am told, in relation to those two conflicts. So plainly, that is a problem. Our ability to digest different issues is complex. The second aspect, I think, on double standards is it's clear that there are double standards all around. Let me give a couple of examples. The United States and the UK object every time Russia targets a electricity station in Ukraine because plainly that's not permitted by war crimes law. But then those two countries, Britain and the US, pass in silence when Israel shuts down the electricity in relation to Gaza. Plainly, that is not permissible in relation to war crime standards. On the other hand, Russia targets civilians all across Ukraine, including the killing of my dear friend, the writer Victoria Amelina, eating lunch or dinner in a pizzeria, killed by a targeted Russian missile. And all of a sudden, Russia has discovered the joys and the need to protect civilians in the context of Gaza. So I think the double standards abound all around, and this is a real problem. Your role as journalists is to point these out.
Philippe, in that spirit, I think we should also point out that it was a violation of international human law to take hostages on the part of Hamas as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I and seven other lawyers in Britain put out a statement, which was published in the Financial Times in mid-October, making exactly that point. What happened on the 7th of October was a manifest violation of international law and a crime in many regards. Israel, secondly, has a right of self-defense under international law. That is my view. But a third point, and the most crucial in the respect of this conversation, is that in exercising that right of self-defense, it must act within the law. And that is what's causing so much grief right now, I have to say, including for me.
You know, Philippe, it's extremely important to have, a kind of rational, careful approach to problems that don't lend themselves to rational or careful analysis.
Thank
Wonderful
you so much,
speak with you.
Philippe.
Wonderful
it's great to have you.
Bye.
Let's take a break. And when we're back, the big question here, which is, are we really now finally at an inflection point for the Biden administration when it comes to Israel and the war in Gaza?
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Yeah. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Evan, I want to turn to you. You've been following this incredibly closely ever since October 7th. Is this the moment when we're going to see a decided shift or even possibly a break between the Biden White House and Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Well, in some ways, you can borrow the words of Anthony Blinken this morning as he was describing how he will judge Israel's actions on this. He said the test is in the results. And that, I think, applies also to the administration. I think, you know, there has clearly been a change. And, you know, I'll tell you just sort of you guys appreciate the subtleties here. Oftentimes, White Houses are torn between wanting to say, yes, we're changing our position, or saying, no, nothing has ever changed. We've had total fidelity and total clarity throughout. So they're sort of back and forth on this. But this is a case where they are acknowledging that they clearly have moved on this. And I think I was talking to somebody about this, trying to get a feel for what happened. You know, is it some member of Congress? Is it a call with a Jose Andres? Is it – and, you know, I think that the truest representation of what's happened is that Biden is a political creature. We know this deeply. And he has been out in the world giving speeches, being heckled, being interrupted, being aware of what is resonating with people and where he is weak. And not to say that his calculations are purely political, but that's part of his job. And I think there is a degree to which he has looked around and realized, to our earlier comments today, that he had to catch up to where the country was on this.
Yeah, Jane, how much do you actually think there is political risk for Biden from his own party in this? Do you think it's significant that there have been, you know, well over a few hundred thousand Democratic votes in primaries this year to uncommitted as a protest for Biden's policies in Gaza? Do you think any of that matters, or will those people just sort of come home to Biden no matter what in November?
I mean, it's hard to predict, but I think that at the moment it feels so inflamed that he really has to pay attention to this, particularly if he wants to keep the younger voters in the Democratic coalition, which is very important. And I mean, I think it is a domestic political issue for Biden. And one of the things interesting to me was, one indication is, take a look at what Trump is saying about this. Even Trump is saying this is a really bad PR problem. And he's saying that the Israelis, you know, you should get the cameras out of there. Don't let people see these pictures. They're not handling the PR well. Trump's a pretty good indicator of when he sees a political problem that is threatening politically to his own needs. And he's looking at this saying, I don't want to be too close into this. They need to shut it down, finish it off, whatever. He has a completely incoherent position. But just the same, he realizes this is a big political and PR problem.
To this really important question of, will Democratic voters ultimately come back to Joe Biden, or will they stay alienated on this issue? I remember talking to one of Biden's most senior political advisors on this question, and I said, what do you think it comes down to? And this person said, the single biggest thing is whether this is a 3 or 4 month war, or does it go on longer? And as you guys know, we are now talking at the 6 month mark. So this is clearly going to have a long and complicated shadow over this election.
You know, Evan, I'm glad you brought that up. I was really struck this morning listening to Chris Murphy, one of the senators that Jane mentioned, talking and pointing out not only that we're 6 months in, but there's no scenario that looks like winning for Israel in the short term. And that's the thing that I keep coming back to. And by the way, I think there was a hope in the Biden White House that it would be over quickly. But I do recall interviewing a very senior State Department official who was part of those early discussions with Israel. And he came out of it, and he actually said to me back in the fall that he thought that, and had been told by the Israelis, that this war could last for years. And I just don't think that people really fully absorbed what that meant, that this was a major reevaluation for Israel, that their policy of sort of containment, isolation of Gaza had failed. And we're talking, we don't even know who is going to govern the spaces that Israel has already, in theory, finished its military kinetic operations in. There's no strategy that they've outlined.
We're already looking at a kind of an escalation here, yeah, where you have had a strike during this last week also by Israel in Damascus against the leaders of the Quds Force of Iran as a sort of a retaliation for Hezbollah's role on the border between Lebanon and Israel. I mean, you can see how this thing might be escalated by Israel, which is going to create a greater problem for the Biden administration. And a
future Trump administration for that matter,
yeah,
right? That's the thing. This isn't going away. That seems to be one of our big takeaways today, and it might actually, as Jane just pointed out, be escalating. So anything hopeful we've gleaned from the conversation today?
I think it's helpful that Biden is pushing back publicly now, not just behind the scenes. I think that this push to try to help open up another gateway for humanitarian aid is important. It's too late, I think, in many ways, but at least it's happening. I mean, and these are important differences. And I think one thing that you can say about Biden is he has been tolerant so long of so much bad behavior on the part of Netanyahu that it's very hard to criticize him at this point for not having been loyal to Israel. I think that the kind of criticism that he might have gotten if he had done this earlier is really diminished because he's hung in there so long.
Evan, a final word for you.
You know, I think the final word belongs to Jose Andres in many ways. I mean, he had a very thoughtful set of reactions to this catastrophe this week. And one of the things he said that gives us a little reason to be mindful of or optimistic is, as he said, this is a war against humanity itself. And he attributes the start of it all the way, of course, to October 7th. And he says that is a war ultimately that cannot win because humanity eventually, as he said, will always prevail. And there is something that is inspiring about what Jose Andres does. Right now, they've pulled back. Their ships are back in Cyprus. But I don't think there's any question that he and his organization are going to be back at it, and they deserve all the support they can get.
Jane, Evan, great to be with you this week. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Great to be with you.
Thank you, Susan.
This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. I'm Susan Glasser. And if you have thoughts on the show or questions, please send them to themail@newyorker.com. Don't forget to include the subject line, The Political Scene. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Dan Richards, with editing by Gianna Palmer. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Condé Nast Global Head of Audio is Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. We'll be back next week. Thank you so much for listening.